Game Boys.
Let's do it. The president of France, Emmanuel Macron, has blamed video games and bad parenting for the mass riots that have been going on across the country for over three nights. And that was my first instinct too.
Yeah, I remember that I was like, "Hey Griffin, did you see that France is in an uproar over how the cops killed this kid?" And you were like, "Oh, I guess bad parenting and video games have made their way to France."
You could tell that they were all gamers because they were all using, you know, swords that were also guns. They were cosplaying.
Yeah, a whole bunch of cloud stripes running up on the barricades.
Yeah. And so it's kind of hard to, you know, shed responsibility for that.
It's at that point. Increasingly funny how this thing has sort of happened where video games and like home life have become such a sort of scapegoat for kind of all sorts of like deviation from like social norm behavior stuff, that like you're looking at a thing that is so clearly like a dissatisfied populace watching like a nation with like a very specific national history turn away from its legacy. And then everyone's like, and they're getting pissed off about it. And then everyone's like, "No, that's video games, actually." Like, very few countries are as proud as of like the ideology of their revolution as France. Like, even America is less proud of the ideology of its revolutions as much as the event of it. Like, France is so happy that they were like, all the poor people decided democracy was good and they killed the king with a guillotine. And that was awesome that we did that. And we still have this tradition of like hyper-mobilized populace. And that's really cool. And
well, France is, you know, they are primed to be pissed because they had the worst Assassin's Creed game.
So
historically, they've been a pained country seeking revenge for a long time. But it's coming from within.
You have these two like paired factors, this sort of like national pride and ideology, and also this like rage over the failed Assassin's Creed game.
Assassin's Creed Unity.
What a disaster. Yep. And then you have this thing happen where the cops kill this kid that is so obviously at odds with that national identity and also sort of a piece with the failed Assassin's Creed game.
Well, maybe that's what Macron was referencing, actually, was not the protesters, but the cops were playing too many video games.
And they had bad parents.
And the cops had bad parents. They had really bad parents. And so I think he's spot on. I think this is, context is key.
Yeah, I just think it's so, like, this is the funniest example of this thing where there's like a clear historical and material story for why a thing is happening. And then someone just goes, "I think too many video games."
I feel like the people that are in power right now are the last generation to like socially be able to miss video games growing up as a kid. Like, "Oh, I didn't play them. I just kind of did other stuff." Like, that's just not true of any 12-year-old now. So like, I felt really old when I heard this, because this has been something that I've heard since I was a kid and it feels very cyclical. But then I was like, you know, this is just not going to fly when like half of Congress grew up in Fortnite lobbies.
Yeah.
Like, so like, you know, savor it while you can, folks, because
we're actually talking about
bad video games and parenting, that ain't going to last.
We were talking about this on Pixel Goblins, actually, that like, once this current rage of like gerontocratic presidential people like goes away, like the next wave of presidents like will have played Final Fantasy games. Like we're on the cusp of a moment where like,
and that will be the most partisan issue, yeah, actually, is whether they're good, yeah, or not.
We're going to lose the Democratic Republican Party and just have the Final Fantasy V party, the Final Fantasy VI party, Final Fantasy VII party. And those will be the three dividing sort of political rubrics. But yeah, it is like we are just on the cusp of that being a thing where like we're on the cusp of the president knows who Sephiroth is, which is crazy.
The president's VP is Sephiroth.
Yeah, well, you know, what, President Genova?
Yeah, I think so. I think that'd be a good one.
Genova 2024.
Yeah, I'm with her.
Yeah, people just hate to see a girl boss winning when it comes to...
People hate to see a girl boss meteor shatter the planet. I'm loving this Monokuma / Grimace, but I am a little grimaced out. Should we talk Grimace for a second?
I watched someone drink the shake. I didn't drink the shake.
I don't know.
I saw someone do it, though.
The Grimace... the Grimace and the Grimace TikTok kids. I don't know. I'm not enjoying it.
I thought the shake.
I'm feeling a little get off my lawn about it all.
I thought the shake looked bad. I don't. When I saw it in real life. Mm-hmm.
And was it true that you had to get, that you had to order the full meal to get the shake? That's what some people were telling me.
I don't know, because Forrest, who I was with, did not even hesitate to order the full meal. We pulled up to McDonald's and he was like, I'll take the Grimace meal, please. Zero hesitation. So I don't know if you need to, I don't know. He just did it. But I saw the purple color and it didn't look like food to me. So that was disconcerting. But he drank it and he said it was good, although he also has weird food taste.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said before, I'm feeling a little get off my lawn about it. All the TikTok kids creating like morbid commercials about the Grimace thing. I don't know. It's a lot of complicated feelings, because basically all the kids are drinking the Grimace shake and then pretending to be dead. And everyone is doing that now, and everyone is feeling like very creative and hilarious when they do it. But it does seem to be the same sort of like Mad Libs kind of jokification of like everything that's comedy now online, where they're like, the format is like established by one person and then there's like 20,000 iterations on it. And I don't know. I kind of am exhausted with that stuff. But then when you take that, and then you like lend that to a corporate entity like McDonald's and essentially give them a ton of like free advertising, it's like the corporations are all now trying to essentially just create these like meme containers that people want to like run with. Yeah, totally.
I mean, that's the thing, is like, I have mixed feel. Aesthetically, I don't like it for basically all the reasons that you said. Like, it's, they're not like writing super new jokes or doing anything super experimental with it. It's just sort of like playing in a space someone already.
I think the first time it was funny. The first time someone did it was funny. But now everyone's like, look, I'm doing it too.
And I see that there's like sort of a social value of like exchange with that, where like, oh, everyone's in on the joke and they get to feel like part of a thing. But the problem, like you say, is that like that comes at this cost of like you're just doing ads for McDonald's. And they're not that funny.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, calling it like a problem is like, it sounds like I'm calling it a problem. I guess I'm just saying it's like annoying and exhausting. And it's not like feeling like I'm living in like a corporate ad that everyone is like enthusiastically getting involved in is not why I went on the internet, or like why I like Twitter or like experiencing like stuff like that, like the internet was supposed to, I guess, be about, or at least a promise of. It's like I don't know. I think the ads are winning, folks, so hats off to them.
It's this thing where like there's like this trickle down production, like this trickle down productivity thing, where like,
you're right, we need Bidenomics.
Like everyone's like, in order to be like a productive part of society, you kind of have to like participate in these things. But the forces that dictate what these things are largely corporations. So the best way to like be part of the world is to like do corporate work for free, which is not a good thing, I think.
It is sort of like, I will say though, it is, in terms of its like impact in the world, it's a lot more positive than like the evil soy Szechuan sauce Rick and Morty debacle. It seems like this one, they've engineered a more positive experience. At least like no one's being murdered over the shake. Well, I guess because they have quantities of it.
The bit is at least kind of whimsical, as opposed to like being strictly antagonistic.
Yeah.
Because like the Szechuan sauce bit was like, give me your sauce, you piece of shit. I'm screaming at you. You make $12 an hour and I'm yelling and I'm screaming at you your job. And that's what we're putting on the internet. Whereas this is like, I bought a milkshake and I fell over. Which is at least a little bit more palatable. Speaking of palates, do you know what Grimace is?
He's a palate?
But that was kind of a hint. But
well, then what do you mean, kind of speaking a hint of palates?
Do you know what Grimace is?
He's a... What's a palate? A palate like a wood palate?
No, like a taste palate.
Oh, he's a taste bud?
Yeah.
That is weird. I don't want to personify a single taste bud.
I was at a bar And so, and we were all hanging out. I think Rory was there. And so, and yeah, I was hanging out with Nat and Rory.
That can't be right.
I was
hanging out
with Nat and Rory, and Nat was like, "Do you know what Grimace is?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. Why would I know? What is, like, an alien?" And she was like, "He's a taste bud."
Grimace, who is actually an enormous taste bud, was first introduced back in 1972 as Evil Grimace.
That's so funny.
Wait,
the Inuit character is Evil Grimace.
He was introduced as evil. He initially had four arms and was known for swiping all of the cups from McDonald Land to stop anyone from having milkshakes or Coca-Cola. Wow, what is this? This guy was evil. Oh, wait, wow. This is a way different vibe. Yeah, I'm gonna send you this. You gotta see this Grimace's face.
You gotta know a lot about Evil Grimace.
Look at his face. So Evil Grimace was definitely more of a high school jock bully type. And he's very intimidating, wider eyes. He looks like he's got a grill.
Yeah.
Of some sort. And then, however, after the original Grimace left young customers frightened, McDonald's switched up his look. We changed him to a soft, plush, two-armed blob of a sweetheart who only wanted McDonald's milkshakes and to hang out with Ronald. Wow, this is like a big this is what they had to do with
Toy
Woody.
Story. Yeah,
in Toy Story, that's right.
It is McDonald's Land, like that world, like at its inception, was like so fucking crazy, where there was just a Hamburglar stealing all the hamburgers, Grimace was swiping all the cups, Mayor McCheese was like insanely stressed out, Mac Tonight was like trying to get everyone under control.
There's a Game of Thrones amount of lore and characters happening. Move over, Final Fantasy 16.
We should bring it back.
I think we should. I don't like that he is an enormous taste bud.
I hate
because
that.
Because it forces us to consider that our tongues are just have all these little blobs sticking off the top of them,
which is like
not a like makes you feel itchy. I do like Evil Grimace because I think that McDonald's for a long time has been sort of missing a big bad.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to write a plot for Ronald without him to like act against something.
Right. Yeah. Well, for so long, Ronald's had to fight the demons within, sort of like a Guts, you know, berserker wolf kind of situation. Because wasn't there an evil Ronald or a cousin of his that's evil? I remember there's like a black stocking Ronald or something.
Let me do it quick.
A mischievous Ronald. What I liked about the Grimace Shake, though, was that it was bringing back the characters because there is this large Game of Thrones-esque ensemble of deep lore. And I feel like for a long time, McDonald's was like, well, actually, we're a brand for everyone. We don't want to just be a place that kids like. So, you know, mascots are for kids. And it's like, no, the mascots are for everybody. Having a rich sense of history is for everybody. You know, learning about love, friendship, and betrayal in a Game of Thrones like setting with a large ensemble cast, that's what fast food is about. And the play places now, they feel unfocused and everything feels unfocused. So I think it was good for them to bring character back to McDonald's.
I mean, I don't like what they're doing with Grimace, but I think it is still, like you're saying, I think it's still a step in the right direction to like give. The one thing this world needs is more lore and more wikis.
I think now we need Hamburglar's hump day. And every Wednesday you get
a little everyone at the McDonald's wears a little mask. And if you don't eat quick enough, the employees run out and steal your hamburger and eat it in front of you. And they go robble, robble. And then they just jam your quarter pounder in their mouths.
Oh, what if it's like a thing where it's like, yeah, you have like 30 seconds to eat this or then you have to pay.
Yeah, if you can swipe it. They give you a chance.
Yeah, you take this McDouble from the palm of my hand
exactly.
If you dare.
Choose the McDouble or the sword. Eat the hamburger or die like your mother.
I just think bring the characters back, bring them all back, because I think we will, because Grimace obviously was such a viral sensation.
Yeah, I can't wait for the Hamburglar's birthday.
Who, outside of Hamburglar, is there any other ones that are like this?
There's Mayor McCheese. There's Mac Tonight.
I think Mayor McCheese could really do something. Oh, he's frightening though. He's super frightening.
Yeah, he and Mac Tonight are a lot more like creepy, like or like way weirder.
Mayor McCheese may need to stay in the dustbin of history.
No, he's got to come back. He's got to have like a Rob Ford style return.
He would need a complete redesign and makeover, because like everything about him screams like 1982 evil nightmare. And then Mac Tonight, yeah, well, he's too evil, too adult. Obviously, Mac Tonight was what they're trying to go. They're trying to go for the cool guys, cool kids, late night, get your McDonald's late night. Because he's a moon with a perfect smile and some cool jazz sunglasses.
Yeah, I mean,
he's playing the piano.
Mac Tonight has big smoked cigarettes vibes, which is why I like him.
Yeah, like he smokes them inside the McDonald's, and
then kids get secondhand emphysema.
My headphones went out.
You're in out of batteries.
Keep talking about Mac Tonight.
You're getting censored by big tech. Fucking Mr. Spotify, Mr. Podcast by Spotify is like, we can't have people discussing Mac Tonight, not on this podcast.
Mac Tonight, Mac Today, Mac Forever. I think maybe Mac Tonight. I think we can bring back Mac Tonight if it's Miss Mac.
Oh, Miss Mac.
Because then it's like same exact kind of male forward suit, non-binary moon.
Girl boss vibes.
But girl boss vibes. Yeah. Like non-binary, but she's like she's a you know, BlackRock CEO.
Yeah, it's like a they them. Like a they them person who like signs a piece of paper that like refuses to give health insurance to coal miners with black lung.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
Yeah, Mac forever, Miss Mac. Well, I think let's move on to the real Mac attack of this episode, which is Final Fantasy 16. We took a week off to really dig into the game, and because I think Lux had some social obligation. I don't remember.
I had to work on a show for like 3 days at the beginning of the week, and it got all fucked up time wise.
Yeah, a show, aka his OnlyFans.
Yeah, my OnlyFans, where I show feet.
What do you make, like $3 a month doing that? I mean, but you put a lot of content out for that $3.
Yeah. Well, OnlyFans.com/HobbitFeetBoy. And it's just pictures of my weird hairy feet. But
they're placed at the sort of doorstop of the old hobbity doors. That's how you're in like a hobbity space.
Yeah. I'm trying to make it feel as Shire-like as possible.
It's Shire-like. Yeah, it is. It really is. You've done a great job at making every setting look Shire-like.
Yeah. That's what I bring to, I bring a sort of, I'm a real life hobbit vibe to the situation. And you know, the hobbits eat 11 meals a day. And after each of my 11 meals, I post a picture of my feet. After breakfast, after second breakfast, after 11Zs, etc.
People make fun of second breakfast, but I wake up at like 5 a.m. now, and I totally think I get it. Second breakfast.
I often do second breakfast.
For people that are hustling, for people that are like hobbits are, for go-getters, a second breakfast makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It happens to me a lot, because I go to the coffee shop and I get breakfast tacos and I drink a big coffee and then I eat one breakfast taco and then I go, ooh, I'm not that hungry actually, because I just drank a giant coffee. And so then a couple hours later, I eat the other breakfast tacos and that second breakfast.
Wow, I'm really glad you broke right that there, down boom. For the audience.
People need to understand how one can access second breakfast. A lot of people don't think of it in purely conceptual terms, but there's like a material reality to it that people need to understand.
So, we've wasted hopefully enough time. So let's get into Final Fantasy 16. Good or bad?
Oh,
let's
my move God. On. I love it.
Cool. Nice.
What do you think? Top level?
Top level?
Top level. How do you feel about it?
So I... I like it a lot and I like playing it and I'm going to play it all the way to the end, but there's like a lot of things I don't like about it. And I don't feel obligated to finish it. I want to finish it because enough things are working in the game. But I think my top level opinion is that Final Fantasy VII Remake feels like so much more of a cohesive and better game than this game. And I hope that the directions and styles of Final Fantasy VII Remake are more the future of the franchise than this experiment.
Wow. Griffin, I feel the opposite way. I feel like Final Fantasy VII I feel like Final Fantasy VII Remake was stuck between two styles of game design in a lot of ways. Was sort of had a toe in both worlds, and this game is a much fuller commitment to a type of game. And executes that type of game in a much more clear way that pairs a lot stronger with like the sort of story and themes around the action.
I would say maybe in terms of combat, you could make that an argument, but I feel like the 16 probably would feel a lot more focused if it had just been an action combat game and not tried to tack in all these additional like open world side quests and stuff like that, that slow down a traditional action combat game.
Well, so I don't mind the side quests. I do have a thing that I agree with. I do agree with you about this to a degree, which is that I don't think the problem is the actual stuff in the game. I think the problem is how the game frames the stuff to you early on. Because the game does open and sort of present itself as like open world. You're doing side quests. You're looking around. And it's like, that's not true. Like, that's just like the game. That's just a lie. Like,
well, I actually
There's not a ton of hidden content. All of the side quests, once you get far enough in the game, which is not even that far, you can just get from the bar at the hideaway or in the mail.
Let's focus on the combat first before we jump around too many things. So, okay. I mean, you said that it was that Seven Remakes stuck between two worlds, and I think it's the perfection of both because there's so much strategy and being able to pause and use some more turn-based, like slow motion, almost stop motion stuff to plan different abilities, different weaknesses on certain enemies. And there was so much strategy in that. Whereas this game, 16, you have no control of your party members. You are essentially kind of just waiting for your ability cooldowns to be back up. None of the enemies have weaknesses that you need to use specific abilities for. So you can do fire damage to fire enemies. You can't do cold damage to fire enemies that does more. There's just so many things that become so simplified and lack strategy that Remake has in the combat that it starts to feel samey, even though it is flashy and exhilarating.
So here's my take on that, which is a little bit different. I think with Seven, if you want to do that kind of like high strategy, high tension thing, just make a turn-based game. I obviously love those games. I play turn-based games constantly. I'm literally on a clock to finish Final Fantasy 16 because a giant turn-based RPG is coming out in 6 days that I need to play. So like I deeply love that style of game. But like if you're going to do it, then fully do it. And my problem with Seven Remake and also with Final Fantasy 15 is that like it's this stop and start thing that never lets me like fully get stressed out the way I like to get stressed out by turn-based combat and never lets me get thrilled the way I like to get thrilled by action combat. Like it just never hits those highs in that way. And it kind of like has a lower ceiling for that. With 16, what I really like is while there are some ability weakness things like there are people with icon vulnerabilities to specific types of icon attacks that exist in the world. But it's not a huge part of the game, so it's not super important.
Most of the game, you're mashing your abilities in the same way against every enemy.
That's where I disagree. There are like tactical differences. Like there are fights where it's a lot smarter to just drop a lightning rod and fire ignition directly into it and just blow up everything around you with lightning. And there are other fights where it's a lot smarter to like use Phoenix Cyclone to charge your limit break and then go wild limit breaking and then busting out like fire attacks. Like there's there are variances in fights, especially with the big bosses. Well, we'll get to the boss. The bosses are where this game excels. But even with the mobs, there's some variance there. And what I really like, and this is definitely a little bit of like, I like colorful things and shiny objects, like for sure is a part of the appeal here. But like when you do icon and ability combos correctly, it's just so fucking cool. Like when you like,
no, yeah, it's awesome. It's really exhilarating. Yeah,
and that's cool. Cause I like what I like about this game. And it's a thing that I know other people who love Final Fantasy games are mad about because it's a very not Final Fantasy thing, is that like you get to feel as though your character Clive is like the coolest, most badass dude in the world. And some of the stories like hinge on that, like the Black Shield story at Port Isolde is like that, where a bunch of people are like, we'll never beat this army. And then you show up and they're like, oh, this one guy is here. Never mind. This is, they're fucking so done. We are good to go. Even before getting into like the question of like dominance and stuff. And so like that makes the game feel really exciting and makes your presence in the world feel really exciting. In a way that really matches the tone of the story, right? Cause they're just doing like big Euro fantasy stuff. And despite the fact that they are explicitly doing Game of Thrones shit to the point where someone's like, maybe a little ice and fire is all we need. Like, even though they're doing that, they're still...
There's literally a Hodor character, a big Hodor character. Yeah, a big Hodor
character who's like, I get to go on the adventure!
It's insane.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, like, there's basically Bran, only instead of having no legs, he has, like, a lung problem. But, yeah, like, with all of that...
So, I did want to... I know we're already talking on the story now. Well, I did want to just... kind of keep it separated, no, so we can pin you on certain stuff.
To the combat for a second. I'm just talking about.
Oh, okay. Because you're talking a lot of the story.
I'm talking about the tone of the thing. It's like the thing they're doing is still like this kind of like big hero protagonist Euro fantasy thing where like chosen boy goes on big adventure, and the combat really makes you feel like chosen special sword boy. Like you get to do so many cool things. It looks so cool. It's exhilarating and exciting and like empowering in this way. That just matches the type of story they're telling so effectively.
That's the best part of the combat. And the reason it's so flashy and exhilarating, like, is the only way it's forgiven for having such repetitive combat, because it looks so fucking cool and feels good to play. So it like doesn't matter as much that there's like not that much strategy in a lot of the battles, except for like a few, and excluding like the boss battles and stuff, like, because it's so flashy and just so unlike anything you've seen before on a spectacle level, you kind of like still want to play it, and you forgive it for some of its, I think, oversimplifications. Let's talk about the story a little bit, because you mentioned Game of Thrones, and I feel like this story should be our favorite story like of all time, because it feels like the creators were like, oh, we watched Game of Thrones and Attack on Titan, and we're just going to make a story that's both of those combined. Because it really has taken the like primals, which have always been these like summons and have existed in different ways in the Final Fantasy franchise, and now they've kind of turned into like the human turning into a mech, turning into a big titan, turning into a big powered guy, with like dominance being these people that can turn into primals. Having that layer, that Attack on Titan layer, combined with this sort of like Game of Thrones, multiple different kingdoms and factions sort of brutally and callously attacking each other. What is your take on like how they've pulled that off so far? We're both about, I would say, 50 to 60% through the story. I'm like currently too.
One major beat ahead of you, I think. I guess like
okay.
Two, like one like story chunk that is a couple of major plot beats, but like I'm like one little step ahead of you. But like, yeah, I think I really like it. I think they're doing something, they're doing a better job at something that the Game of Thrones TV show fucked up, which is that they're doing a better job of balancing the political and magical plots. Although there's one thing that they're doing that is driving me fucking crazy, which is that there are three or four times throughout the game where, okay, we're just going to put spoilers here. Like we're going to do plot spoilers because we have to talk about it. So if you don't want to know the plot of the game, come back in a little bit. But like Joshua shows up. Turns out he's alive. And there are so many parts of the game where Joshua is somewhere and he's talking to someone and he's like about to say something extremely revelatory about what's going on. And then the game just like cuts to something else. And it's starting to make me feel insane because
it's very bad Final Fantasy. When they do
that's
that,
really frustrating because I think narratively, like in terms of like what's happening, it's a really good thing where like, this country's doing this and this dominant is doing this. And there's also this like Ultima Mythos thing happening in the background that's clearly implicating it in some way. That's interesting. But they are just like rubbing it in your face, how they refuse to tie it all together till you get far enough, which is very annoying because the beats I think are good, but there's just not quite enough context for me to super understand. Like I'm excited by and interested in the beats, but I don't understand all of them enough all the way.
Yeah, I hear you on a lot of that. And I think that's my big critique. And I do feel a little harsher on it is that I'm actually really intrigued. There's been a lot of talk about how the side quests were boring and stuff like that. And I actually find the side quests to be the best parts of the game.
I like seeing how the little world works.
But not only that, but like it's the only part that like actually sticks its landing on like what it's supposed to be and not like kind of having some shitty part of it that feels half full, like I feel about the combat or how I feel about this story, because like I really liked the first 2 hours and then like Clive is so boring and like he speaks like a tough guy ASMR is how I would describe it. Like there's been
such a funny thing to imagine.
There's so much like praise for this voice actor. And I think it's one of the worst voice performances in a long time. It's just like, what's going on? It's just like, it's like ASMR. It's really unexciting. And so even though like I feel for his plight or whatever, he's had some shitty stuff happen to him, he's really boring to listen to. But then you meet his half sister fucking Jill, who is even more boring. This is one of the most boring characters in a Square Enix game in like a decade. Like her face is completely frozen, like, and it is just so generic, so basic, and just like, so this party is just like, it's like watching paint dry.
Yeah, both Jill and Clive frustrate me because I think that both the voice actors have their moments that are pretty good, and even the characters have story moments I think are pretty good, and it's frustrating because like, for instance, when you go to like the Greek Orthodox island to kill everyone and blow up their mother crystal, the Iron Blood Island or whatever, Jill in that section is like interesting because there is this like kind of seething anger and like lust for blood.
At least there's something to sink your teeth into, but then the performance is still so stiff, then, and so much of it's like,
at least that like gives you something and you're like, this character has like stuff going on. And then after that, you go back to her just being like, of course, Clive, I'd love to go on an adventure with you. And it's just like, remember before when you were like, I'm going to kill this man with a sword? Like, that was tight. But now you're just back to being right. That shit's frustrating. So I think
it's just, it's one of the worst parties in a long time in a Final Fantasy game. Well, and like, I feel like every character has been so boring.
I think that's one of the things that I agree with, it struggles with, is that it's not telling a party story. It's telling a guy story. Like it's doing classic Euro
fantasy.
And he's
boring too. So you're fucked either way. Yeah, for sure. Like it's like you're fucked either way. It sucks. It sucks. The coolest characters are Benedicta and the Titan dominant guy and the dog
and
the side quest characters.
And the Wulu general guy who's just like hot and is like, yeah, sure, Your Majesty. We'll kill everyone. Whatever. I like that guy.
Right. Whatever his name is. I'm frustrated on the party level in terms of its blandness. I'm liking some of the villains, but I think they're also not fully, because they're trying to do Game of Thrones, they're trying to do Final Fantasy moments, they're spinning a lot of plates. I feel like in the time that they have in a video game to tell a story, they haven't earned enough moments with characters for me to care about all 7 of these kingdoms moving across the board. It becomes really hard to track. And it's just like, it just feels like kind of like they're not nailing the Game of Thrones moments anymore, because they're not nailing the character moments to build to these, to these moving armies and these betrayals. And so again, it's like, I love the instincts, but it feels like a half full idea.
I think, at least in my opinion, and this is where I'm curious what you'll think about the next like 4 hours of your playthrough, because I don't think you'll change your mind, but I think you'll have a little bit more of a positive opinion on it, because as the game just blows up more places, right? Like as you destroy Mother Crystals and more kingdoms get like absolutely wrecked, the narrative becomes more focused by default, because like more things get taken off the board. And so the dynamics become a little bit more interesting. It doesn't like it. I'm not going to say that it fully fixes the problems you're talking about, because it super doesn't. Like those are still there, but they it becomes more legible and dramatically interesting just because there's fewer things for them to like bounce around between. Like they kind of have to hone in on stuff, and so that does help. And like there are fun parts of it. Like I don't know how this one lady, the Clive's evil stepmom or whatever, I don't know how she's capable of just birthing.
What is her deal?
I don't know. Like, she has a magical power to give birth to the wimpiest little boys in the world. Every boy she births is a little dweeb. Like, first you get Joshua, who grows up to be kind of cool, but when you meet him at the beginning, is just like, I'm a little nerd.
Well, I haven't really met this other kid really, like, fully, so I don't know much about him.
I mean, he doesn't say anything until like, I think I just heard his first like line, but like just every shot of him being like, I'm a sleepy little prince, I'm so tired, and above all of this stuff, I'm a sleepy little prince, is very irritating. But I do think that there's at least enough there that I can invest in the political level stories and on a quest level. Like I get into doing the stuff that is like us fucking with the politics of XYZ place, or like, why are there royalists here? Or like, how are these Imperial guys doing this thing or whatever? Like there's enough for that to work. And the boss stories and the culminations to boss fights and that stuff super works for me, again, largely just because of how good the boss stuff is, like gameplay wise.
Yeah, again, it seems like you agree with me, but then you're like, oh, but there's these cool parts. Fights and the spectacles are really good.
To me, it's like, that's what the game's about, right? Like,
right, but if that's what the game's about, then don't spend a lot of time doing these other things that the game's not about. And yeah, that would be my take.
I think the difference is that I have a little more patience with that other stuff, and I think it, at least for me, is a little bit more effective as far as giving me plot motivation energy to deal with the stuff between boss fights.
Yeah,
like, because that's its job, right? And at least for me it works. I think it sounds like a little bit better than it works for you, because like it's for me serving that purpose, if not transcendently, at least like functionally. And again, like for me, like for this game to be really, really fun and sweet to me, it just needs to give me enough that I'm not like bored out of my skull between like incredibly cool boss fights, which is what it's doing. So for me,
the
like
boss
totally
fights
fun.
Are so creative and so incredibly like the definitely like the graphics test of the PS5 in terms of how far they can push this thing. It's just so incredible the way some of the graphics and the fire animations and the elements and how many effects that are playing on screen at once. It's really cool on that level. And the moment-to-moment defining is pretty fun. So yeah, there's like a lot of stuff there. And then I really am enjoying the side quests. The side quests are just phenomenal. I am into building this hideout, like hideaway, where like these like, enslaved peoples are trying to escape to, and you're trying to kind of like free them. The world itself feels like distinctly like unfair and bad. So it's cool. And like you feel invested in wanting to like do the side quests and help people in the world, even when it is really small ways. So I am enjoying all that stuff, and it is enough to keep me playing through the whole thing. I can't help but feel like this is just like there's just a few too many areas where I'm like, man, I wish this was just better. Well,
That's fair. But, and then just to extend the psychos for a second, I also think, and you kind of got at this a little bit, but I also think that like it does the thing I love side quests in these kind of games to do, where like every time you do a side quest, you get to like learn like a little micro slice of how the world works. Like you go talk to someone and you get to learn about like the cool store where everyone gets their twine or whatever. And that's always for me a really fun part of side quests in these kind of games like that.
Well, it's usually not just like learning about the twine. It's like learning about like the city or the society or like something a little bit more than out, just the to, twine itself.
It fills in the gaps of like this time of this world in like really detailed ways. And I think that's part of honestly why I'm not so mad at the plot the way that you are, is that I think a lot of the stakes of the plot get elucidated through the side quests, so that like when you have a scene where the emperor is like, well, we'd better get ready to destroy these guys who are in Dalmechia. I'm like, oh, that's like where this cool side quest happened. And like, that's where my friend lives. Like it makes those a lot more effective.
It makes the stories
a little more effective by like threading you through that. But again, like that is more the side quest than like the cutscenes or plot itself for sure. But they do that job.
And if like, and if the main plot was still just the way it was, but Clive and Jill were just more entertaining as characters and as a party crew to be around, then like there would be so much more forgiven again there. But because they're not, you're left kind of stuck with this very drab feeling the whole time. I would also say, you know, I was playing Final Fantasy VII Remake leading up to this because I was excited to play 16, and I'm struck by how much better the facial animations are in 7 Remake.
That's true.
Like a lot of the times, a lot of characters, it's only the bottom half of their face that's like moving, and it's just the jaw, and the top is super frozen. And it's like very, you know, earlier video game style stuff. And it really goes to show that like, yeah, they were able to like put out all the stops on like these spectacle boss fights. But that did mean that like certain things had to come off on other parts of the game. And it's interesting to see where they decided to peel back. And it's definitely in the facial animations, which for me personally really hurt connecting again with this crew, especially when I saw like the animations of like Tifa or Aerith, and then like going from that to Jill was like, it felt like a decade like had gone back in time. Remake,
by the virtue of both the type of story it's telling and how it wants to tell it, like needs facial animation to work that way. Like 7 Remake would be like a catastrophe if it were animated the way that this game is animated. Because like it's so much of that story is about this idea of Cloud becoming part of this bigger thing. And like your attachment to that world and those people and the idea of what that attachment means and how it gets problematized by like the weird ghosts and stuff. And that's cool. That's cool as shit. But it's not the same set of goals as 16. But 16 does suffer for this, right? Like, that's why like Ralph Innocent as Cid, like the game is like largely elevated when like Cid or Benedicta or Kupka are around, because like those performances give the scene so much more dynamism because they're fun. Like even Cid, who's very much like a stock, like
Gerard Butler type.
Yeah. Clive Owen guy, still works because at least he's like kind of fun and has some movement in his character from moment to moment.
Right. Even though his face again is very frozen.
Yeah.
Like I was like, this guy's charismatic, but his face is fucking a rock. It is not moving.
Well, it's because the Blight gave everyone like a type of palsy.
That'd be a great reason. Yeah.
But yeah, so it does create a little bit of a problem there. Like it is frustrating this way where like when I think about the story in like an abstract sense of like what's happening, I'm like, this is very compelling and interesting to me. Like I like all these things. I like that there's this lady who's like somehow able to manipulate all these people, and I'm curious what her secret is. There's this empire with this tension of like who's in charge and why. There's this kingdom that's like very secretive but scary and powerful. There's a weird Greek Orthodox island full of giant men who need to die for some reason. There's a desert republic doing all the stuff. There's stuff in the background. All that stuff's cool. But then the cutscenes themselves, like in terms of their details and dynamics, don't work nearly as well as like I guess the way to put this is that I don't lose a lot zoning out on a cutscene and just checking the active lore function that like tells you what happened.
Which is a cool function.
It's a great function, but it shouldn't feel as, it should feel more supplementary than like substitute-y than it does. Like it literally feels like I can zone out on a cutscene and just like pull up the active lore thing and be like, oh, that's what's going on. Yeah. And that's not what you want, for sure.
Speaking of zoning out on a cutscene, let's get to the ad. Want to make a podcast? Spotify's got a platform that lets you make one super easily, then distribute it everywhere and earn money even. All in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works.
Spotify for Podcasters lets you edit, record podcasts right from your phone or computer. So no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today.
Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard.
Video podcasts are also available on Spotify. And when you want to take conversations with your fans to the next level, Q&A and polls are the best way to get them talking.
You know who took conversations with their fans to the next level? Miranda Sings, what's her name? Colleen Billings or something?
Oh, yeah, she sure did. If you ever want to sing a ukulele.
She loved Spotify.
Yeah, she loved to put her little ukulele songs on Spotify and then send her underpants to her fans. That's such a weird thing that happened.
With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions.
And best of all, it's totally free with no catch.
Ever since I discovered Spotify for Podcasters, I feel like I've been able to get to that Miranda Sings level of podcast quality where I'm at the top of my game. I'm millions. I have the ability to get millions of fans and connect them in DMs. But consensual. They're generally contacting me first. It's all with the help of Spotify for podcasters. Go to the spotify.com/podcasters to get started. And let's not be so quick to cancel each other.
Yeah, surely there's a reasonable explanation for why an adult would do these things. Come on. It can't possibly be as weird as it sounds. That's crazy.
Let's get back to the show.
Okay, let's take a second to actually talk about the boss fights in Final Fantasy 16. Because we've talked a lot about how we've like kind of hand-waved them by being like, obviously they're great, but we haven't actually gotten into how good they are.
They're very good. I feel like they're like, if you're gonna make them quick time events at times, you have to make them look as crazy as anything you've ever seen before. And that's what these are.
Yeah, they do a good job of using the quick time events not to be a challenge of like, can you hit the buttons in time? But just to be like, we're taking a break from the fight to introduce this like cinematic set piece. And we're not just like fully pausing the fighting. Like you have to still do a thing, even though it's a very simple, easy thing. But like it breaks it up in a way that is like exciting and cool and crazy.
And honestly gives me some of that spectacle that I've been missing in like your God of War 2s and like your other AAA video games of that level that like promise that spectacle. But then like it seems like you're fighting like humanoids for a lot of it. Like it's fucking awesome when you're like two giant monsters crashing through like a mountain or something. Like it's promising that thing that I feel like we thought we were arcing towards, but then like the most recent batch of AAAs like haven't really been doing that as much.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it does this great job of giving you these fights where you're like pumped up Clive versus like a guy who's going crazy. Like you're like when you fight Hugo, like you're fighting this fight, you're a regular guy, and it gives you a good challenging sword fight thing with like you have to do dodges, you have to use your moves, you have to like figure out staggers, all that. And then it says, you've had enough of this. Time for you to become a big flaming dragon guy and fight something else. And that shit is fantastic. Like, mm-hmm. But both the sword fight boss fights and the kaiju fight boss fights really work, and they do a good job of changing, of like mixing up what you're doing. And so, like, one thing we talked about at the very beginning was that, like, the combat gets really repetitive. When the kaiju fights happen, it's always pretty distinctive. Like, they do a really good job of giving each one its own feel, introducing new mechanics, introducing new approaches, just like totally style mixing it. Like, slight spoiler for you, but when you eventually do fight Titan, which is inevitable,
they're like full of ideas. Like, they in the way that like a Mario 3D game is like full of ideas, like they constantly are throwing like new fun things at you in them. It's not like all just like the same button mashy two Godzilla types fighting that each time. It's like there's a lot going on to them. That's like, it's just, there's so much creativity to them. It feels like a gift each time you get to one.
Yeah, and you get to like integrate new stuff each time. Like, a good example is like when you fight the boss Typhon, they're like, by the way, if you hold circle you can super jet around, and then Typhon has a bunch of attacks that you absolutely have to super jet around to avoid, which gives the whole fight.
And when you start super jetting, it's like you feel like one of those moments where you're, it's like, oh, like, yeah, like like, I don't know, it was such a badass moment where you're like,
yeah, it feels so
it feels great.
And so, and each of the boss fights, each of the kaiju fights kind of have some of that. And so they do feel like really distinct and exciting. And it makes like, it makes everything, like, it feels like you're really building to something, and it like really sets every arc. It's like part of why all the arcs, I honestly, this is probably part of why I'm as generous to this game narratively as I am, is that all of the arcs feel like they stick the landing just because the boss fight that punctuates them feels great. Like, I think I'm a little more generous with the narrative there because I'm like, oh shit, all this stuff happened and then this thing happened, and now I'm so jazzed on the story because of this, how cool I feel after this event that happened, as opposed to like it really necessarily being like purely effective on a narrative level.
Yeah, I would love to see the next game take like the amazing spectacle stuff they've done here and apply it to like some of the battle systems and story that I've liked from the last game. The last thing I wanted to ask was, are you playing with any of the necklaces that make the game easier? And how do you feel about like dodging in the game?
No and good.
Nice.
My only problem with dodging in the game is that I constantly forget that the Phoenix Shift ability doesn't have invincibility frames, even though you disappear for a second. So I suddenly am like, oh, I'll use that power to get closer. And then they just like hit me with a stick, and I'm like, oh, I guess that didn't work. And that's annoying. But the actual dodging is great. Getting the Berserker necklace that gives you bonus damage to precision when you precision dodge is really fun. Because then you can just precision dodge over and over and over again and become like insanely powerful.
Yeah, so which is, I'm a big fan of like parry precision games like Sekiro and stuff like that, but I find the dodging in this game to be a little sloppy. First, I don't like that there's not two separate interactions, one for parrying, one for dodging. They're kind of combined. And I find some of the telegraphing of the boss's moves to like be awkward or clumsy. In the big icon battles, it's really good because the characters are very large. But I find like a lot of times that like I'm not able to like the frames between like if a wolf is just like an enemy wolf is just like standing still in like kind of like aggro mode, and then when it jumps and like does its bite, there's like so few frames between them sometimes that it's like hard to get those perfect parries for me. And that's someone who like loves Sekiro, but I still, even like 25 hours in, I feel like I haven't mastered the dodge, and it feels always kind of like sloppy when I'm doing it.
I kind of like that because it's like they mess with your timing in a lot of ways. Like, I think that's a pretty intentional thing, is to like change the rhythms of the bad guys and like to fool with your timing to make the dodging harder. And like you have to like kind of solve the puzzle newly each new bad guy that you meet. Mm-hmm. I think is kind of fun. I do agree though that sometimes the way they do that is to make things move in ways that just like don't make sense or like feel really weird. And so like I see why they're doing that, right? Like it is to like create a more dynamism per like from fight to fight, to be like, this like ninja guy moves really weird. So you have to like learn how to adapt to that. But sometimes it's like, okay, but like, so he just like goes from standing still to like flying through the air, spinning his blades with no indication. That's pretty weird to me.
Yeah.
And the exact, it's just a little off.
I don't know why, yeah. But for me, it's just a little, it's not as it's well, like, cause like Sekiro has all the things you just described. But for some reason it just feels so precise that like when I lose on a parry or a dodge in that game, it feels like I really did lose it. And sometimes I'm like, I think I got that one. Like
Sekiro, I think Sekiro for sure. The like visual idea of what the moment of parry and dodge is a little bit clearer than it is in this.
Yes.
Like this thing is like kind of a proximity thing in a way. And I think that becomes confusing because like this happened in a fight I was just having where I was fighting like one of the bounty hunt thing. That's like a ninja guy who runs around. And it was annoying because like I said, I use the Berserker necklace where I get bonus damage from precision dodges and I was dodging all of his attacks, but they weren't precision dodges. Cause I like, wasn't letting him get close enough, even though he'd already started his attacks. His attack is like a jumping spin thing. And so it's like the exact moment where the precision dodge lives when someone's like attack is just like running at you weapon style is like kind of ambiguous in a way that it makes sense, like I said, to like create these like internal puzzles of timing, but it doesn't read in a clear way until you just kind of like trip over
and find it. I think they design it knowing that because it's so forgiving in terms of getting hit. Like it's not like Sekiro where you could like in Sekiro, you couldn't get hit as many times as you can get hit in this game when you make mistakes. And that goes to show me that they know that it's like not as precise, and then it's sometimes it's like hard to read those telegraphs, so they're gonna like be forgiving with it and like assume that like most people are gonna get hit a lot and not be able to perfect dodge everything, which to me is just another thing I'm just like I wish that every hit mattered and it was more precise, but that's just me personally. I know they're trying to open this up to a wider audience, so I think it was a design thing that they meant to do.
I think I kind of agree. My thing is more like if you're going to make that the style and the way that they chose to do that, like as far as dodge style goes, you should have more approaches than being a dodge guy. Like if you want to make it so being hit is forgiven, like let me sacrifice dodgeability to just be beefier, or like let me sacrifice beefiness to have better dodge or damage output. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like just something.
Like either
there's more fun ways to make it accessible than that. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, they're not like doing RPG builds, which I get. But then by not doing it, they just kind of give your characters really middle of the road experience of like the specifics of combat. And as much as I love the combat, I do want to stress, like, I fucking love it. It's so fun. Like Devil May Cry, but with sword and like fire magic is so very fucking sick to me. But there is this thing that I think we're talking around that is like, it's like giving everyone multiple trapdoors to escape from problems in a way that makes all of it feel a little bit shallow, not like shallow mechanically, but just like stakes wise, like, oh, I missed a dodge, but I have 3000 health and, I have, you know, once you get like 9 potions or whatever, that I can use to heal myself. And also my dog can heal me. And also I can limit break heal myself. And like, so there's not a real tension there and you don't have to make any choices to cultivate a play style. Like you just like do your thing. And if it doesn't work, the game is like, well, that's okay. Here's 55 backups, which again is like an accessibility thing, which is fine, but it just makes those moments feel a little bit less personal and like riveting. Ooh, hiccup.
Yeah. So I know we were going into this game, thinking that it was going to be without a doubt the game of the year. How are we feeling as my final question to you, Lux, now that we've been playing it more, is this still a clear game of the year contender or is the, you know, is the prize back on the map?
So when we were talking about this before, we were talking about how it was like kind of like how when Elden Ring came out, we were all just like, oh, well, that's over. Like game of the year convo is done. Like, obviously, who cares? Like this conversation's like solved. I don't think that's the case anymore, even though that's kind of what we anticipated. I think this is like currently my game of the year and may well still be the game of the year. Because the things it does well, it does so well. And the ways that it like pushes what video games do and how we use video games, like what's cool about video games, is very new and exciting. Like, it's elevated like what boss fights and cinematic combat can do in a video game in a way that is like totally fucking rad. But I don't think it, there are enough gaps in it, no matter how much I super like it, that I think you can make compelling cases for other games to slide in there. I don't think it has an ironclad case the way that we kind of imagined that it would.
Yeah, I don't think it has an ironclad case either now. I think I still like it a lot. I think it's more interesting than a Diablo 4. But I think now, you know, if it does come down to Tears of the Kingdom and this game, I'm going to have to, you know, finish both games and then really draw out some pros and cons, because, you know, Tears of the Kingdom and like a lot of its ideas really are operating on like very high levels that like a lot of the ideas in 16 aren't, but 16 like pushes like the next gen envelope in ways that Tears of the Kingdom doesn't, you know, so tough call, but the race is on.
Yeah, Tears of the Kingdom feels like they took a thing that they know works and iterated on it in an effective way that's really creative and cool. And Final Fantasy 16 said, video games can do stuff that we haven't thought about what video games can do, really. It's time to hit the jets on video games. And that in ways that both succeed and fail. And it sort of becomes this kind of question of like, do its successes outweigh its failures sufficiently that it's cooler than this like next level iteration that is Tears of the Kingdom. And that's like not a, that's not necessarily an easy decision to adjudicate, and one that we have to like kind of look into. And then, you know, who knows what else is going to come out that's going to change the math.
I'm also just so frustrated just technically with these games still. Like where you have to lock it to 4K to get like a consistent 30 frames per second, because if you play performance mode, it like downscales all the way to like 720p at sometimes. And then like, the other thing is they had this motion blur that's so bad when you turn the camera that it's just like there. I don't know. I don't push the graphics this hard if I can't get more of a consistent game from it. Cause like I'm enjoying the game, but sometimes I look at it and it feels like it's like barely holding together.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. It does feel like I said, it's this thing where like, they're in a pressure with this game. Like if the, you know, I wouldn't want this game to have been in the oven for another year, you know, like I'm glad that we have it, but also it's kind of easy to imagine this game being the oven for another year and being the kind of like hyper transcendent game that we imagined it would be, you know, like,
yeah. Sorry for that. We were trying to wrap the show. Sorry.
No, but that, I mean, I think that was a good cue to end on. But yeah, this game rocks. We'll probably hopefully have it finished next week, and I'll also have started Trails into Reverie and continue the Trails quest with Trails number 10.
And you know what, you guys rock too, all 10 of you that are, yeah, now on an FBI list.
Yep, because this is a psyop, and we're all going to jail, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
This is like, yeah, the least successful psyop of all time. Goodbye.
Hey, we got rallied.